Penguin Random House Audio presents The Daily Dad, 366 meditations on parenting, love, and raising great kids. This is the author, Ryan Holiday. First, say to yourself what you would be, then do what you have to do. Epictetus. Introduction. A lot of people have kids, not enough people are parents. It might seem like having a kid is what makes you a mother or a father, but we all know it isn't. There are plenty of people who take their kids to school, buy them clothes, put food in their bellies, give them a warm bed to sleep in, but who are not really parents. They act more like legal guardians, checking boxes to get through the day in the first 18 years. That is not parenting. That is the minimum. It's a sad fact that some don't even manage to get there. They seem to think that their obligation ends at conception or birth or the day the divorce papers are signed. Procreating is biological. Parenting is psychological. It's a decision, a conscious choice, a commitment to actually change who you are and what your priorities should be for the benefit and betterment of your children. Commitment to sacrifice and service and the real work of making hard decisions, of loving, not just having. Being a parent is the choice to make your children, if not the center of your life, then central to your life. Embracing the fact that bringing these little people into the world has changed everything about who you are, what you value, and what your duties are. A person with kids does enough to stay on the right side of child protective services or to avoid the raised eyebrows of their neighbor. A parent makes a commitment to a timeless set of principles that can feel like cliches but are rare enough in practice to be noticed when someone actually lives by them. You know, put your family first, love unconditionally, be present, help them be who they're meant to be, lead by example. Take nothing for granted. Live with gratitude. But let's be clear, this is a modern choice. It's not an exaggeration to say that just a few generations ago, keeping your kids alive was about all that was expected. A child was seen as a future asset that began as a liability, another set of hands to help work the land on the family farm, or a warm body to slot in on the line at the local factory and draw wages to help make ends meet. Even the early years of the 20th century were still a gauntlet of obstacles defined by mortality and infirmity. If all your kids made it through, that was a bona fide miracle. That you had a responsibility to care for them emotionally, to love them unconditionally, please, who had the time or the ability? There is a story about Winston Churchill, who was by no means a perfect father, but had been raised by two self-absorbed and preoccupied aristocratic parents, themselves products of Victorian England. One evening, while talking to his son Randolph late into the night during a school holiday, a thought struck Churchill. "You know, my dear boy," he said with a kind of forlorn amusement, "I think I have talked to you more in these holidays than my father talked to me in the whole of his life." It was not only not an exaggeration, but far from uncommon, and for many years afterward continued to be common. It may well be relatable to you and your own childhood. How sad that is, not just for the children, but the parents too. For generations and generations, parents, especially fathers, were deprived of the most rewarding and beautiful thing in the world, being involved in the lives of their children. Loving them not just generally, but actively on a daily basis. The flip side of a patriarchal culture that burdened women with the whole of domestic life has been the soft bigotry of low expectations for men at home and with their children. Loving and being loved, understanding and being understood, nobody taught it to men. Nobody demanded it of fathers. Again, think about how different history might have been if more parents had been parents, if insert villain had been raised better, if insert greedy businessman had been made to feel enough, if insert heartbreaking victim had been protected, if insert anonymous nobody had been equipped to fulfill their potential, if somebody had told insert powerful person they were proud of them. While we can't change the traumatic past, we can write a better future. And that's the philosophy that underpins this book. Despite the flaws of generations past, parenting is one of those beautiful experiences that links us in an unbroken chain back thousands and thousands of years. One of the most beautiful passages in the writings of Lucretius, the Roman poet, captures the joy of a father bending down as his children race each other to jump into his arms. One of the oldest pieces of evidence of humans in America is the footprints of a parent, probably a mother, walking in what is now White Sands National Park, carrying and then setting down, carrying and then setting down, carrying and then setting down a young child. This thing we're doing, our wild, chaotic daily existence, the one filled with joy and difficulty, love and labor, it's a timeless one. The ancient world was unfathomably different from our world today. Those footprints in New Mexico are intermixed with those of giant sloths and ancient camels and extinct species of mammoth. Yet somehow the experience is one that you've had countless times at the park, walking back to the car after dinner, at the beach on a vacation. Parents have always worried about their kids. Parents have always played games with their kids. Parents have always made plans for their kids. Parents have always tried to be a model for their kids. Parents have always tried to support and encourage their kids. Parents have always questioned, doubted, and wondered if they're doing enough, if they're providing enough, if the school is good enough, if the sport is safe enough, if the kid's future is secure enough. They were doing the same thing they're doing now, and it's the same thing people are going to be doing 50 generations from now. We are part of something timeless and eternal, something very small and very large at the same time. This should humble and inspire us. It should give us purpose and perspective and practical advice. Parenting is a topic that every philosophy and religious tradition has spoken about. We can find lessons on how to control our temper in front of our kids from Plato, lessons on how to cultivate a peaceful home for our kids from Marcus Aurelius, lessons on how not to spoil our kids from Seneca, lessons on how to support our kids from Queen Elizabeth II, lessons on how to inspire our kids from Florence Nightingale, lessons on how to cultivate curiosity in our kids from Sandra Day O'Connor, lessons on how to cherish our time with our kids from Jerry Seinfeld, lessons on how to balance our careers and our kids from Toni Morrison. Lessons on how to believe in our kids from the life of Muhammad Ali. Lessons from mothers who survived the Holocaust, fathers who led the civil rights movement, sons who became war heroes, and daughters who won Nobel Prizes. The Stoics and the Buddhists, the moderns and the ancients. We can learn from it all. Like my previous book, The Daily Stoic, this book is built around accessing all that advice, one piece at a time, one day at a time. I recommend that you begin on the page with the date you are presently holding this book. Don't wait until January 1st. Start today. Wherever you begin, the power of the book resides in your picking it up daily, consistently engaging with the material, because even though the pages stay the same, your kids will change. The world will change, and you too will change. My book, The Daily Stoic, is now well into the second half of its first decade. With more than 1 million copies in print in 40 languages, there are people who have read it every day for years. Even though the book is the same as it was when I submitted it to the publisher in the fall of 2015, it continues to connect with and be of service to people all over the world. There's a Stoic observation about how we never step in the same river twice. For both we and the river are in a constant state of change. This metaphor holds true for parenting too, and The Daily Dad was designed around this very idea. It's not a book for expecting parents or parents with adult children. It's a book for anyone at every stage in their journey. Each day's entry will strike the single parent of young twins differently from the new empty nester, just as the same entry will strike that same parent differently if they pick it back up the subsequent year. And let us linger on the idea of picking it back up for a second, as it is a critical theme in the philosophy of this book, as well as good and present parenting. Parenting, like the pursuit of wisdom, is a lifelong affair. No one is expecting you to magically get it. In fact, that is the fundamental flaw of too many parenting books. You're supposed to read some book, be it in the scramble before they're born, in the sleep-deprived toddler years, or in some crisis when they're older, and then be good? That's not how it works. On a minute-by-minute basis, your kids and life put you in situations you could have never imagined on your own, and that none of the books seem to anticipate. So while there is no sudden transformation in parenting, there is still a process, a working at it that you must take up. And that is what this book, One Page Per Day, is built around. Not a one-time thing, but a morning or an evening ritual, a checking in, a continual process. We will fall short. We will lose our tempers, get distracted, prioritize the wrong things, even hurt ourselves and the people we love in the process. What then? Just as with the pages of this book, we must pick back up where we left off. We must accept the fact that we are flawed humans while doing our very best to learn from our errors and not to make the same mistakes twice or any more times than we already have. Dust yourself off, recommit, do better. That journey, The Daily Dad as a book and as an idea, is of course not just for men. Our daily email, which has been free at dailydad.com, is received by thousands of women each morning. It's called The Daily Dad because I happen to be a father of two boys, and that's just about all you need to read into the name. Whether your kids are old or not yet born, whether you're a step-parent, a co-parent, an adoptive parent, gay or straight, whatever gender, this book is about the journey to become the parent you're capable of being, that your children deserve you to be, that the world needs you to be. It is not a short journey either, from birth to legal adulthood, as culture sometimes defines it. No, being a great parent begins long before that and ends, well, never. For even after we leave this life, our children will carry with them good and bad, the lessons we taught them by word and deed. Raising children, or as I heard a parent once correct an interviewer, raising adults, since that's the goal, is the hardest thing you will ever do. It is also the most rewarding and important thing you will ever do. That's what this book and the hard-won wisdom of generations past is about. You are a parent. You are every parent who has ever lived or will ever live. We are in this together. Now let's go do our best together. January. Teach by example, the only method that works. January 1st, a little fellow follows you. In 1939, 9 years before John Wooden would be hired to coach the UCLA men's basketball team, a friend sent him a picture with a poem on it to celebrate the birth of Wooden's first child. The picture is a man on a beach whose son is running behind him, following in his footsteps in the sand. Wooden hung the picture in his home so that he might see it every day. The poem, which he memorized and liked to give as a gift, went as follows. A careful man I want to be, a little fellow follows me. I do not dare to go astray, for fear he'll go the selfsame way. I cannot once escape his eyes. Whatever he sees me do, he tries. Like me, he says he's going to be that little chap who follows me. You don't have to memorize these words as Wooden did, but you better internalize their message. Your children follow behind you. They see everything you do. If you go astray, so too will they. January 2nd. Never let them see you act like this.
I think of myself as a philosopher only in the sense of being able to set an example. Friedrich Nietzsche.
There is a story in Seneca's famous essay on anger about a boy who at a very young age went to live in the house of Plato to study under the famous philosopher. Returning home to visit his parents, the boy witnessed his father lose his temper and yell at someone. Surprised by this violent outburst and with the simple innocence of a child, the boy said, "I never saw anyone at Plato's house act like that." However we conduct ourselves in front of our children, particularly at home in private, they will come to see as normal. If we are rude or unkind to our spouse, they will assume that is an appropriate way to treat people they love. If we are anxious and overly worried, they will come to think that the world is a scary place that must be feared. If we behave unethically or cynically, so too will they begin to lie and cheat. January 3rd, their faults are your faults.
Don't worry that children never listen to you. Worry that they are always watching you. Robert Fulghum.
Your kids can drive you nuts. They can push your buttons. They can ask an interminable number of questions, the way they can mimic you. I love him very dearly, I guess, because of his faults, which are my faults, the novelist John Steinbeck writes of his son. I know where his pains and his panics come from. Our kids have our virtues and our vices. That's what makes this whole crazy parenting thing such a wonderful opportunity. Because we are here to help them become the best possible versions of themselves. And one of the ways we do that is to help them become like us in all the good ways. But one of the other ways is to prevent them from becoming too much like us in all the bad ways. It can be an incredibly difficult balancing act if we aren't honest or self-possessed, if we let our egos get in the way. Can't let that happen. This is our chance, our time, to help them, to bolster them, to help them overcome flaws that maybe we never quite got over ourselves, to seize this second chance, to give what we didn't get. More than that, it's a chance to understand. January 4th. Show them how to keep their cool. In 1952, Margaret Thatcher's father was driven out of office when a rival political party won a majority in the election. He was upset. He was hurt. And he could have allowed those emotions to drive how he reacted. But he didn't. Instead, Thatcher's father made a statement of incredible restraint and dignity. "It is almost 9 years ago since I took up these robes in honor, and now I trust in honor they are laid down," he said. And he added later, "Although I have toppled over, I have fallen on my feet. My feeling is that I was content to be in, and I am content to be out." We could say that what he was doing was showing his daughter how to lose with grace, but it is much more than that. He was showing her that external circumstances don't define us, only how we respond to them. He was showing her how to bear adversity and how to never surrender your poise or self-control. These would all be lessons that Thatcher would use throughout her tumultuous life as a public servant, a prime minister, and a mother. Your kids will need them too. So show them. Show them by example, not just with words. Show them when you've been screwed over and it really hurts, that still your personal code of conduct matters more. Because it does. Because it will. January 5th. Which will it be? In his Broadway show, Bruce Springsteen explained the choice presented to all parents. We are ghosts or we are ancestors in our children's lives. We either lay our mistakes, our burdens upon them, or we haunt them, or we assist them in laying those old burdens down. And we free them from the chain of our own flawed behavior. And as ancestors, we walk alongside them and we assist them in finding their own way and some transcendence. Will you be a ghost or an ancestor to your children? Will you haunt them or guide them? Will you curse them or inspire them? Of course, we all know which of those two we want to be, just as Bruce's flawed father surely did. But then our demons, our issues, the ghosts of our own parents get in the way. And that's why we go to therapy and read good books. That's why we stay up at night before bed talking to our spouse about how hard this parenting thing is, to exorcise those demons by bringing them into the light. It's why wordlessly, when we hold our kids, we promise ourselves to do better, to try harder, to not repeat the mistakes we endured growing up. This isn't going to be easy. We're not going to be perfect, but we're going to keep trying. We're going to be an ancestor, someone who guides them and inspires them. We're not going to haunt their future selves like a ghost. January 6th. Hang their pictures on your wall. He could not have known what the future would hold. He could not have known how he and his country would soon be tested. But in 2019, Volodymyr Zelensky gave a 20-minute presidential inaugural address to the people of Ukraine that foreshadowed how he would respond. Despite being one of his country's greatest success stories, making a fortune in the entertainment business and then holding its highest office, Zelensky asked not to be celebrated or held up as a model. "I really do not want my pictures in your offices, for the president is not an icon, an idol, or a portrait," he said. "Hang your kids' photos instead and look at them each time you are making a decision." Then in February 2022, in an act of brutal illegality and avarice, Russia invaded Ukraine. Zelensky stood and fought, refusing opportunities to be rescued. What could be motivating him? His own advice. He has two children, ages 18 and 10, for whom he fights. The Ukrainian military and its citizen soldiers were similarly motivated, fighting valiantly alongside him against incredible odds for the chance that their children might live in freedom and live proudly, knowing that when it counted, their parents were prepared to sacrifice everything on their behalf. Each of us should be inspired and humbled by this example. But as Zelensky said, we don't need to put pictures of heroes on our wall. Instead, we can hang up pictures of our children and strive to make them proud. And this should inspire and fortify us when we have to make tough decisions for their future, for their safety, for their freedom. It is our kids who compel us to do the right thing because they are always watching. January 7th, they learn from home.
It is constantly reiterated that education begins in the home. But what is often forgotten is that morality begins in the home also. Louis L'Amour.
You tell them to be good, to be honest, to follow the law, to care about other people, that safety comes first. You say these things, but what do you do? You can't say that you care about other people and then speed through stop signs because you're late. You can't tell your kids that honesty is important and then lie to get out of the ticket. What's worth more to you, avoiding a fine or living your values? That's what you have to ask yourself in every situation, particularly the ones where your kids are watching. Is getting what you want worth teaching the wrong lesson and undermining the values you are trying to instill? Those kids buckled in behind you, they are absorbing your example and assimilating the lessons that will shape them in the smallest and biggest of ways. From the kind of driver they are going to be to the kind of person they are going to be. They are watching you as you go through the world right now. They are watching you break traffic laws, break promises. They hear you when you lie. They feel it when your actions don't match your words. Kids learn from home. They learn in the car. They learn from mom and dad. You set the standard. So be the standard. January 8th. How are you embodying your values? On April 1st, 1933, shortly after coming to power in Germany, the Nazis held a boycott of all Jewish businesses. It was the first small persecution of many to come, but too many mothers and fathers who had talked to their kids about doing the right thing simply went along with it. Not everyone, of course. Dietrich Bonhoeffer's 99-year-old grandmother, for instance. On that day, she was out shopping and she refused to be told whose businesses she could support. She ignored or dodged the Nazi troops stationed in front of the stores and shopped wherever she liked. Their grandmother marching past Nazi guerrillas came to be seen in the Bonhoeffer family as an embodiment of the values they sought to live by. The embodiment wasn't lost on Dietrich, who 10 years later would lose his life plotting to assassinate Hitler. Even though he was a pastor, even though he had plenty of opportunities to escape Germany and live in peace and freedom in London or America, he stayed. His grandmother's example guided him, showed him how to live by his values. Let the same be true for you and your children, whatever the future holds, big or small. January 9th, protect this great invention. The author, educator, and cultural critic Neil Postman points out in The Disappearance of Childhood that childhood is a social construct. Genetic expression makes no distinction between who is a child and who isn't. Children, as we understand them, have existed for less than 400 years. The idea of childhood is one of the great inventions of the Renaissance, he writes, because it allowed children to develop, to learn, to have a safe space to play and explore and discover themselves. Like any invention, childhood can disappear. How? With the disappearance of adulthood. Childhood, as both a social structure and a psychological condition, works when things like maturity, responsibility, literacy, and critical thinking mark an adult. But when things like long-form writing and reading decline, the gap between child and adult shrinks, the line between them blurs and then dissolves. As parents, we have to protect this great invention. We have to increase the gap between childhood and adulthood. Let them be kids, but also make sure that you are being an adult. Be a leader. Be responsible. Be an example, a model they have to strive toward. Let them see you with a book they can't yet comprehend. Let them be around adult conversations that they can't quite understand. Let them see you working and sweating and providing. Let them see an adult so they have something not just to look up to, but to look forward to as well. January 10th, your living is the teaching.
Example is not the main thing in influencing others. It is the only thing. Albert Schweitzer.
Socrates' students said of their teacher that for all the genius he possessed, Plato and Aristotle and all the other sages who learned from him derived more benefit from his character than his words. So it was for Zeno and Cleanthes, the two earliest Stoic philosophers. Cleanthes would not have been the express image of Zeno, Seneca wrote, if he had merely heard his lectures. He shared in his life, saw into his hidden purposes, and watched to see whether he lived according to his own rules. Is there a better description, a better bar to set for parents than this? If you want to teach your kids, it's not going to be with words. It's not going to be with lectures. It's going to be through showing them that you live according to the rules you set, and the values you are trying to tell them are important. January 11th. We can be that gift. Marcus Aurelius's father died when he was young. But then this young boy who was cursed by tragedy received a great gift. A gift that all children who have received it know to be one of the most incredible things in the world. A loving stepfather. Ernest Renan wrote that more than his teachers and tutors, Marcus had a single master whom he revered above them all, and that was Antoninus. All his adult life, Marcus strived to be a disciple of his adopted stepfather. While he lived, Marcus saw him, Renan said, as the most beautiful model of a perfect life. What were the things that Marcus learned from Antoninus? He learned the importance of compassion, hard work, persistence, altruism, self-reliance, cheerfulness, keeping an open mind and listening to anyone who could contribute, taking responsibility and blame, and putting other people at ease, yielding the floor to experts and heeding their advice, knowing when to push something or someone and when to back off, being indifferent to superficial honors, and treating people as they deserved to be treated. It's quite a list, isn't it? These lessons impacted Marcus so deeply he remembered them far into adulthood and recorded them for his own reference in what would become Meditations. What made the lessons so powerful was that they were embodied in Antoninus's actions rather than written on some tablet or scroll. There is no better way to learn than from a role model. There is no better way to judge our progress than in constant company with the person we would most like to be one day. January 12th. Don't talk about it. Be about it. Tim Duncan is likely the greatest power forward in the history of the NBA. 5 titles, 3 NBA Finals MVPs, 15 All-Star appearances, 15 All-NBA team selections, 15 NBA All-Defensive team selections. The most devastating turnaround jumper off the glass that basketball has ever seen. And he did it with a selflessness and poise that are almost unmatched. Almost is the operative word, of course, because Duncan was helped along on this journey to greatness by his predecessor and teammate, David Robinson. How did these two superstars connect? How did one mentor the other? In his NBA Hall of Fame induction speech, Duncan explained, "People always ask, what did he tell you? What did he show you? I don't remember one thing we sat down and talked about specifically. But what he did was he was a consummate pro. He was an incredible father. He was an incredible person. And he showed me how to be a good teammate, a great person to the community. All those things. Not by sitting here and telling me how to do it, but by being that." We are better off embodying our philosophy than talking about it. As the Stoics said, it's a waste of time to speculate or argue about what makes a good man, a good athlete, a good teammate. Our job, they said, is to be one. And this is how it goes in sports, in life, and for parents. Sure, we can talk all we want. We can have great conversations. But what matters is what we do, who we are, how we act. January 13th, here's how to have lasting impact.
To be in your children's memories tomorrow, you have to be in their lives today. Barbara Johnson.
Whether you know it or not, whether you knew them or not, your grandparents have had a significant impact on your life. They did that through the values they instilled in their children, your parents. And now you're passing many of those lessons on to your own kids. That's one person having an impact on 3 generations. When you think about it like that, it's not an exaggeration to say that your grandparents quite literally changed the world. And they did it in the smallest of ways, with just a few conversations, with how they went to work every day, with the books they read in the evening, and the manners they displayed at dinner. They did it in the conversations they had when their kids made mistakes. They did it in how they treated their neighbors and mowed their lawns and plowed their driveways. There are a lot of things we can do to change the world. We should try to do all of them, but we have to know, and we can never forget how much impact we can have on the world right here at home. Through our children, their children, and their children's children, we can have a profound multi-generational legacy. That's an incredible power. Don't neglect it. January 14th. Where do they learn to judge?
I have a 2-year-old son. Know what he hates? Naps. End of list. Dennis Leary.
We wonder where our kids learn to judge, or worse, where they learn to be biased or to think less of this group or that one. There's only one answer. They learn it from us. It was a comment under your breath about your brother's spending habits. It was a joke about a celebrity's weight. It was a complaint about the way your neighbor parks in their driveway. It was the conversation between you and your spouse over dinner about what's wrong with the other side, with them. You didn't mean anything by it. You don't really care, but your kids heard it, and they can only read your lips, not your mind. We want kids who are open-minded, who give people the benefit of the doubt. But are you showing yours what this looks like day to day? Sure, you're not a bigot, but are you always kind? You would never say something cruel to someone's face. So why are you saying it behind their back, especially when your kids can hear you? The world needs less judgment, less bullying, fewer opinions, period. Can you start this trend at home? Can you teach your kids what that looks like instead of letting the same old rumor mill spin round and round, grinding their goodness to dust? January 15th, if you want your kids to respect you.
You will earn the respect of all men if you begin by earning the respect of yourself. Musonius Rufus.
Every parent wants to be listened to. We want our advice to be taken seriously. We want to be looked up to. Most of all, we want to be respected. Well, if you want your kids to respect you, be worthy of respect. Just think about it for a second. Why would they respect advice that you don't live by? Why would they admire you when you're not living up to your own potential? Why would they look up to you when you yourself are dealing poorly with self-esteem issues, when you have accepted the lies of imposter syndrome and allowed them to affect how you act as a parent? Get your stuff straight. Be the parent you know you can be. Be the person you know you can be. The rest will follow. And if it doesn't, well, then at least you'll be strong enough to deal with whatever comes. January 16th. Don't let your kids down.
The warrior ethos rests on the will and resolve of Spartans to defend their children, their home soil, and the values of their culture. Stephen Pressfield.
If you don't know the story of the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae, here's what happened. The ancient Greek king Leonidas led some 7,000 men, 300 of whom were Spartan warriors, into a battle against the invading army of Xerxes the Great and more than 300,000 Persian soldiers. The Spartans held the front line for 2 days, but on the third, they were finally overrun. Leonidas ordered the 300 Spartans to remain and fight, sacrificing himself and his men to allow Greece to live and fight another day. How did Leonidas choose the 300 warriors he would lead out to the hot gates to a battle with an overwhelming enemy? They were all fathers of living sons, according to Plutarch. You might think that it would have been the opposite, that parents would have been allowed to sit out potential suicide mission, but that's not how it worked in Sparta. These warriors were chosen because parents would never want to let their kids down. These fathers would fight most bravely, most fiercely, not only to protect what they had back home, but to protect the reputations of their family's names, which might be all their children had left if they were to fall in battle. To abandon their comrades or to behave in a cowardly way would be to risk great shame in the possibility of letting down the family that so looked up to them. Our kids are whom we should want to impress. They are the ones we should never want to let down. They are the ones we're fighting for, also the ones whose standards, whose natural admiration and love we should always be fighting to live up to. January 17th, you can't be a hypocrite.
The only thing worse than a liar is a liar that's also a hypocrite. Tennessee Williams.
A few years ago, the Emmy-winning actor William H. Macy was asked for the best piece of advice he had ever been given. Never lie, he answered. It's the cheapest way to go. Lies cost you a lot, and they're never worth what they cost. But as the authors of Unacceptable, Privilege, Deceit, and the Making of the College Admissions Scandal noted, precisely as Macy was giving this interview, he and his wife, Felicity Huffman, were fabricating their daughter's SAT scores without her knowledge, as it happens, and they were planning to do the same with their youngest daughter. The worst part? His daughter wanted to go to a theater school that didn't even require high SAT scores. It was the cheapest way to go, and yet not remotely worth the cost. Macy's wife would briefly go to jail for her role in the fraud scheme. His daughter was crushed. Not only was the whole scandal a massive embarrassment, but she also had to bear witness to the hypocrisy of her parents, who had talked so much about being good people and then had done such a bad thing, the motivation for which was that they didn't believe in her. No child deserves that. At the very least, they deserve parents who live up to what they say. Give your kids that. Don't be a hypocrite. January 18th. Teach them to be particular. Kids are picky. They don't like this. They don't like that. They need those to be exactly like them. But that can't possibly be what John Lewis's mother meant to encourage when she repeated her motto to her kids as they grew up. Be particular, she'd tell them. What she meant, David Halberstam would write in his powerful book on the civil rights movement, The Children, was be careful, be responsible for yourself, and always be well prepared. This was a set of standards that she tried to hold her kids to not only when they were little, but all their lives. In the 1990s, when her son John had become Congressman John Lewis and was well into his 50s, she was still reminding them of her motto. When John faced off in a series of political fights with Newt Gingrich, Willie Mae Lewis called her son and said, "I want you to be particular with that man." Meaning, again, as Halberstam writes, that he was to be careful in his criticisms of Gingrich. Any attack had better be factually accurate. Not picky, but particular. Not peculiar, but particular. Be exacting. Get your facts straight. Do your job. Don't let anyone or anything excuse you from it. Do it well. These are wonderful reminders to give our kids, but as always, it's much more important that they see us living these lessons. Show them the difference between picky and particular, between factual and fatuous, between compromise and compromising your standards. Show them what responsibility looks like. Show them how to be careful and how to always be prepared. Because someday you won't be here, and they will have kids of their own who will need to learn these very particular lessons from them. January 19th. Where did you see that?
Without a ruler to do it against, you can't make crooked straight. Seneca.
Your daughter gets mad, so she slams the door and screams. Your son makes himself a snack and leaves the kitchen a disaster for someone else to clean up. You hear them say something rude to a waiter. You see them write something offensive on social media. Before you get mad, before you condemn their actions, just take them aside. Ask them kindly and openly a question that the bodybuilder Mark Bell says he always asks his teenage kids. Hey, where have you seen me do that? This is a great question because it may well be that you have been inadvertently modeling behavior you find repugnant in others. And while that's no excuse for bad behavior, it's useful to know if we have been tacitly condoning the wrong things to our kids. But if you haven't, then they have even less of an excuse. January 20th. Do the things you want them to do. You want your son to be strong and to be honest. You want your daughter to be those things too. You want them to work hard, to help other people, to be respectful to their parents and the people they meet on the street. You want them to be clean and organized, to laugh and be resilient. Of course you want those things. Everyone does. The question is, how do we raise good kids? And the answer is staring you in the mirror. The best-selling author and father of two, Austin Kleon, talks about how this is the hardest part of parenting. You have to be the kind of human being you want your children to be. You have to do the things you want your kids to do. I find this with parents all the time. He said they want their kids to do things that they won't do themselves. He wants his kids to be readers, so he makes sure they see him reading. He wants them to explore different hobbies and interests, so he makes sure they see him practicing an instrument or tinkering in a sketchbook. He wants them to work hard and find work that they care about, so he makes sure that they see him working in his studio. He wants them to treat others with respect and kindness, so he makes sure that they see him giving their mother something he made for her. Who you are forms who they will be. So be who you want them to be. Do what you want them to do. It's hard, but it's the only way. January 21st. What are they learning from how you carry yourself?
That's what we're all doing. We're setting examples. And our conduct will have a great bearing on our youth, certainly. And our youth are our future. John Wooden.
From his dad, Bruce Springsteen learned about shame, broken pride, and struggling with demons that you can't quite conquer. You can hear the pain it caused Bruce in many of his songs. As unlucky as Springsteen was to be dealt that hand, he was also incredibly lucky to have a mother who set a very different example. In his memoir, Born to Run, Bruce writes about visiting his mom at her job as a legal secretary. "I am proud, she is proud," he writes, recalling how it felt to see her in her element away from their house, doing her job. Bruce could see himself in her, and it called him to be better. We are handsome, responsible members of this one dog bird, pulling our own individual weight, doing what has to be done, he wrote. We have a place here, a reason to open our eyes at the break of day and breathe in a life that is steady and good. What are your kids learning from how you carry yourself? Are you showing them, as Bruce's dad did, how to be bitter and angry and lost? Or as Bruce's mom did, are you showing them how to be brave and tough, to find their niche? Is your example calling them to be better or worse? January 22nd. They are always listening.
Children have never been very good at listening to their elders, but they have never failed to imitate them. James Baldwin.
Have you ever heard your kids say something that just stops you cold? One of those remarks that makes you instinctively do a double take. Like that scene in A Christmas Story, Ralphie is holding a hubcap full of lug nuts as his father changes a tire on a snowy night. Old man Parker knocks the hubcap and the lug nuts go flying. "Oh, fudge," Ralphie says. "Only I didn't say fudge," Ralphie's voiceover explains. "I said the word, the big one, the queen mother of dirty words, the F dash 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 word." Old man Parker's jaw drops and his eyes go wide. "Where did that come from?" he must be thinking. "Where did he hear that?" Of course he knows. Ralphie heard it from his father, famous for the tapestry of obscenities he could weave with his words when he was upset. The little fellow was simply following in the old man's profane footsteps. The point is, kids are always watching, eyes, ears, and heart open. They absorb everything. What will they hear? What is going to pour out of you that will soak into them? That is the question. January 23rd. You gotta live up to it. There are some very basic parenting laws that we all know and we all try to get our kids to follow. They involve hard work, sportsmanship, effort, manners, respect, and boundaries. You know the ones. They are the basic rules that every parent knows. There are a million others that we believe are essential to growing up. Some have become cliches, others are simply truisms. But they got that way because we have found virtue in repeating them day after day, child after child, generation after generation. What we think less about is whether we're actually following those rules ourselves, whether we are abiding the laws we seek to enforce. As the billionaire Charles Koch once explained, the main lesson he learned from his father's very hands-on parenting: you can't lecture your kids on anything you won't live up to. You can't tell your kids to respect others and then talk rudely to a customer service representative on the phone. You can't tell them that it's important to find and follow their passion and meanwhile work their entire childhood at a job that pays well but makes you miserable. You can't tell them that family is important if your actions don't show it. You can't lecture your kids. You have to live up to the lessons you want them to learn. January 24th. when you get them to listen. E.H. Harriman was as rich as they come, a railroad baron, a captain of industry. Everything his children could possibly want or need, he gave them. Yet, unlike some wealthy parents, he coupled this luxury with stern maxims and advice. He wanted his kids to do something with their lives, to make a difference in the world. He was fond of repeating, "Great wealth is an obligation and a responsibility. Money must work for the country." We all say things to our kids just as our parents did to us, little bits and bobs of wisdom that we picked up places. We hope they hear us. We hope it gets through. And when it does, oh, that is the best. In 1901, when Harriman's daughter made her debut in society, she was, unlike her friends, appalled at the spectacle, at the parties people were throwing for themselves. It seemed so wasteful and self-indulgent. So she used her budget to found what would become the Junior League, a volunteerism nonprofit that exists to this day to help the less fortunate. She put her money to work not just for the country, but for the world, and in doing so, improved countless lives. We have to remember that his parents were always planting seeds. A comment here, a book we read to them there, a documentary we watch together, an example we set, a person we introduce them to. When we get them to listen, when they really hear us, wonderful things can happen. January 25th. How to deter them.
We must be what we wish our children to be. They will form their characters from ours. John S.C. Abbott.
There are things we don't want our kids to do, so we set up rules. We create punishments. We supervise them closely, and this works to a degree, but it's also exhausting. Meanwhile, we neglect the most powerful deterrent and the most influential motivator, our own actions. Plutarch tells us, "Fathers ought above all to make themselves a manifest example to their children, so that the latter, by looking at their fathers' lives as at a mirror, may be deterred from disgraceful deeds and words. For those who are themselves involved in the same errors as those for which they rebuke their erring sons, unwittingly accuse themselves in their sons' names." If you don't want them to do something, if you want to deter them from some negative influence or bad choice, let your actions be the guide. Let your life both spur and deter them. In this way, you can be their inspiration in any moment. January 26th. Show them what a good marriage looks like. Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt quite literally preserved a future for their children by fighting for world peace. And yet, it's hard not to judge them for the fact that their five children would be married an astounding 19 times. One suspects that FDR bears the majority of the blame for this. He broke his wife's heart with his affairs. He could be imperious and condescending. He had been spoiled by his own doting mother. But nor was Eleanor blameless. She was so busy, she stuffed her resentments and her anger down. She often pretended everything was perfect when, of course, it wasn't. They were also distant cousins, which was more normal at the time, but still pretty weird. How could their kids know what a good marriage was like? They had ringside seats to a complicated power marriage between two people who often put just about everything else ahead of their happiness or duties as spouses and parents. The point here is not to judge the Roosevelt marriage, nor to insist that you must stay in your current one. It's to remind you, your kids learn about everything important from you, including relationships. So what are you teaching them with yours? What are they seeing that you might be blind to? You have to show them what a good marriage looks like. You have to embody what healthy connections and equal partnerships look like, because the example you will set will be their first and most indelible. January 27th. You can be a parent anywhere. When we think teacher, we think classroom. When we think leader, we think corner office or lectern or a general in front of their troops. But the truth is that a teacher can do their job anywhere and in many forms, just as a leader can. As Plutarch said of Socrates, he did not set up desks for his students, sit in a teacher's chair, or reserve a prearranged time for lecturing and walking with his pupils. No, he practiced philosophy while joking around when the chance arose, and drinking and serving on military campaigns and hanging around the marketplace with some of his students, and finally, even while under arrest and drinking the hemlock. He was the first to demonstrate that our lives are open to philosophy at all times and in every aspect, while experiencing every emotion and in each and every activity. As with teaching and leadership and philosophy, so too with parenting. You can be a parent anywhere. You can be a parent every minute of every day to anybody and everybody. You can be that parent in the same way that Socrates taught, by example, by getting down to their level, by being open and adapting to the situation at hand. January 28th. Let them see you work.
A parent who set an example of loving their work might help their kids more than an expensive house. Paul Graham.
Our instinct is to find that work-life balance that so many people have talked about. We aspire to succeed and achieve in each realm, but not if one comes at the expense of the other. We aim instead to silo work, to not let work intersect with our time, with our kids. The problem? Well, where are your kids supposed to learn the importance of a work ethic? How are they supposed to know what a hardworking dad looks like if they never get to actually see it? How are they supposed to learn what work looks like at all? This is also your job, to be the example. There is an old Latin expression, the younger ox learns to plow from the elder. That's because the oxen would be harnessed together. Not only would the kid get to see their mom or dad do what they did, but they'd literally be strapped into it together to learn on the job. Obviously, good boundaries are important. Obviously, you don't want your work life to overwhelm or interfere with your home life. But make sure that striving for this balance doesn't accidentally deprive your kids of an important example that will serve them throughout their lives. January 29th. Make your household first. A critic once advocated that Sparta become a democracy. Lycurgus, its great lawmaker, responded with the quip, "Make your own household a democracy first." It's easy to have opinions about what other people do. It's less fun to hold yourself to your own standards. You don't like the ever-expanding national debt? Okay. But are your finances in great shape? You hate those ballplayers who sign contracts and then demand trades, abandoning the teams who made and paid them. But don't you have your eye on a new career opportunity? You don't like celebrities making a mockery of marriage, but how's your own these days? You think these politicians should grow a pair, but what truths are you speaking in it? What risk? The point is, the place to apply your opinions about the way the world should work is first and foremost in the small world where you actually have some control. That is to say, at home. If you want to see a difference in the world, then model that change and make a difference at home. You've got plenty to work with, plenty to fix, plenty to improve. Start there. Show your kids that change is possible. Show them why your opinions matter and how they can make theirs matter. Let them witness the real impact that comes from practicing what one preaches. Help them benefit from a focus on the practical instead of the theoretical, the actual instead of the hypothetical. Start now. January 30th. They do most of it. When the comedian Pete Holmes heard that Mitch Hurwitz, the creator of Arrested Development, had two daughters who were both in their 20s, he congratulated him. "You did it," he said, acknowledging that his friend had made it through the gauntlet, successfully raising two daughters to adulthood. But Hurwitz refused to take the compliment. "You know," he joked, "they did most of it." Which is true. As we've said before, being a parent is incredibly important, but we're not nearly as important as we think we are. We do our best to set a good example. They do most of the work. As hard as our job is, they have it way harder. Don't you remember being 10 or 15 or 20? You don't remember being a kid, probably because you were so busy literally developing a brain. So yes, it's amazing to see what they've become and what they've done. Just remember that they get the credit and you get the blame. January 31st, you don't stop teaching your kids. Nell Painter was an accomplished adult. She was in her 70s. She was a world-class historian. Yet even then, her mother was teaching her. How did she have the courage to leave a promising academic career at that age and go to art school? Well, her mother writing her own first book at age 65 probably had something to do with it. It took me years to sense the bravery, the sturdy determination her metamorphosis demanded, for she was tougher than I could see during her lifetime, she wrote. I knew she delved deep to express herself with unadorned honesty, hard for a woman, doubly hard for a Black woman, triply hard for a Black woman of a class and a generation. And yet her mother had done it. So when Nell reached her own golden years, she didn't find it strange to try something strange. She didn't mind looking odd or out of place. She didn't mind doing something hard. Her book, Old in Art School, a memoir of starting over, is a testament to what her mother had taught her implicitly and explicitly. We should take from this two things. We never stop teaching our kids. And though what we are doing right now may not be resonating with them, can teach them something in the future. Keep doing what needs to be done. Embody what you want your kids to be. Keep growing. Keep being the example they can follow. Keep teaching them implicitly and explicitly. February. Love unconditionally. The only thing they really want. February 1st. There is no substitute for your love. In his beautiful and vulnerable memoir, Bruce Springsteen writes that his father said fewer than 1,000 words to him throughout his entire childhood. Maybe you're not greeted with love and affection, he writes, because you haven't earned it. So for decades, Bruce tried anything to earn his father's love. In the 1980s, in his 30s, with a few Grammys to his name, Bruce began to struggle with depression. He wasn't exactly sure why. He'd accomplished more than he had dreamed. As an artist, he was beloved by millions and was starting to be discussed in the same conversations as his idols, Elvis, Dean, Dylan. As a son, as a man, as a human being, things couldn't have been more different. He felt completely alone. In that loneliness, Bruce picked up the strange habit of driving through his childhood neighborhood. After years of cruising old haunts, Bruce writes, I eventually got to wondering, what the hell am I doing? He went to see a psychiatrist who didn't need the background story to know that Bruce was sensing that something had gone wrong, and now he was trying to fix it. Well, you can't, the doctor said. You can't go back. No kid can turn conditional love into unconditional love, absence into presence. Springsteen writes in the last verse of the song inspired by that trauma, My Father's House, about how his father's house forever haunted him. It stood like a beacon, calling him in the night. He sings, calling and calling, so cold and alone, shining across this dark highway where our sins lie unatoned. It's poignant and haunting and heartbreaking. From the outside, it looked like Bruce Springsteen had everything. On the inside, he felt like he had nothing. It's evidence of our power as parents. No amount of money or celebrity or awards can substitute for your love. That's all they want. February 2nd. You can't say these words enough.
One word frees us of all the weight and pain in life. That word is love. Sophocles.
Your kids shrug when you say it. It feels weird saying it in public, cliche, lame, vulnerable. You don't want to embarrass them or bother them or interrupt. Plus, they know how you feel, right? You said it 1,000 times before at home. We have a million reasons not to say these words, but all these reasons are wrong because it's impossible to say them enough. I love you. I'm proud of you. It's you I like. You are special. You are enough. You are the most important thing in the world to me. At the end of your life, do you think for one second that you will kick yourself for saying any of these words too much? Or is it more likely that you'll wish you said these things more? Because it would absolutely kill you if you thought for one second that they might not know, that they might not feel in their hearts how much you loved them, how proud you were of them, how nothing, not success, money, or lack of either could change what they meant to you from the moment they were born. Life is full of risks. This is one gamble you do not need to take. So say it. Tell them how you feel. Tell them that you love them. Say it again and again and again. It's impossible to do it too much, but you might as well try. February 3rd. Love without end. Amen. Parents don't just love their children every now and then. As the verse from the classic George Strait song goes, it's a love without end, amen. It's a love without end, amen. Parental love is not something that is dispensed only when things are going easily with your kids, when they listen, when they conform to your expectations. Expressions of love are not just for when they succeed or when everything is going well in your life or in your job. Not every now and then, but always, without end, unconditionally, even when they hit their siblings, when they lie about a test, when they don't want to eat their vegetables, when they want to quit something you paid a lot of money for, when they've reacted in a way contrary to the values you've tried to instill in them. Even if this kind of love is something you didn't get as a kid, even if it seems clouded when you're struggling or difficult to express when you're pissed off, even when they take you for granted or make things hard on you, you have to show them that you love them, now and then and every moment in between. Love without end. Amen. February 4th, love is about service.
Let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed. John chapter 3, verse 18.
Being a parent is about getting them things. The cup of water they need before bed, the new clothes for school, the hug after they fall down or fail. Parenting is being there, literally. It's about being of service, literally. Driving them around, tying their shoes, coming over to do the dishes and laundry after they've come home from the hospital with their own newborn. Holding their hair back as they throw up from chemo treatments. It doesn't matter how old they are or you are. That's what we're here for. That's what we do. Ask them the questions that Tom Hanks has described asking his own children. What do you need me to do? You offer that up to them, he said. I will do anything I can possibly do in order to keep you safe. That's it. Offer that up and just love them. That is love. It's what your job is. You are here to serve. February 5th. Make sure they know that they are plenty. Despite becoming Senate Majority Leader before the age of 50, being elected Vice President and then President, and being the most formidable power broker in Democratic politics for decades, Lyndon Johnson carried a Texas-sized chip on his shoulder his entire life. He grew up poor. His upbringing and his options landed him at Southwest Texas State Teachers College, a perfectly fine school, but not the kind that a president attends, something he was convinced all of his learned and sophisticated Ivy League colleagues were thinking as they witnessed his ascendancy in American politics. His insecurity began early. He never felt like he was good enough. From a young age, his mother placed unfair expectations on him and made him feel like he had to earn her love, that her pride in him was contingent on his succeeding. She made him feel terrible when he failed, like when he decided to stop playing the piano or dancing. For days after I quit those lessons, he remembered, she walked around the house pretending I was dead, and then I had to watch her being especially warm, nice to my father and sisters. It's a sobering reminder to all parents. The feeling of deficiency is far worse than any potential deprivation. So make sure your kids know that they are enough, that they are plenty, that you have loved them from the moment they were born, and make sure you remember that there is nothing they have to do to earn this love. There is nothing they must accomplish to deserve tenderness and affection. They are good enough. The talents and interests and goals they have are enough. February 6th, it takes discipline. In the 1960s, the young poet Diane DePrima was at one of those legendary beat parties that movies are made of. Everyone was there. There were drugs and ideas and romances. Jack Kerouac was there holding court. And yet DePrima got up to leave and go home early. Why? Because her babysitter was expecting her. All the other writers in the room judged her, silently laughed at her. Believers in that line that the pram in the hall is the enemy of good art. Kerouac was not so silent about his disdain. Unless you forget about your babysitter, he said to her in front of everyone, you're never going to be a writer. DePrima, a good parent, left anyway. As Julie Phillips writes in her fascinating book about creatives and parenting, The Baby on the Fire Escape, she believed she wouldn't have been a writer if she stayed. To write and come home on time, she argued, required the same discipline throughout. Practice of keeping her word. So often, important and talented people use their work and their talent as an excuse to neglect their obligations as parents. But DePrima was exactly right to see them both as a matter of discipline and commitment. The idea that anything or anyone is improved by neglecting one part of their life for another is nonsense. But the opposite is true. By keeping your word to yourself and to your children, you are strengthening an important muscle. By being disciplined and protective of your personal life, you're being protective and dedicated to your professional life. Don't let anyone tell you differently. Don't let anyone judge you for that. February 7th, wherever they are, you are too. Buck Murphy was walking down the street in Whiteville, Tennessee in the late 1950s when a white man yelled at him, "How's that jailbird son of yours doing?" It was a delicate subject in the segregated South. Buck's son Curtis had been arrested for taking part in the Nashville sit-ins, which would eventually galvanize the civil rights movement in America. "Where is he?" the man taunted. "Is he still in the Nashville jail?" Now, there were many reasons for the Murphys to be concerned about their son's activism. Of course, they too believed segregation was an evil and they had suffered its many effects. But they also didn't want anything to happen to their boy. They feared reprisals at home. Maybe they even worried that Curtis was trying to change too much too quickly. But in that moment, challenged by a bully mocking his son, Buck demonstrated the thing that all children want from their parents: true support. Buck said firmly, "Wherever he is, I am too." Your kids are going to make choices that scare you. People are going to doubt them. People are going to criticize them. Maybe you yourself doubt the wisdom of their choices. And where they are, you must be too. Love your kids. Root for them. Support them. Fight for them and fight with them. Be beside them and behind them wherever they are. February 8th. They don't have to make you proud.
Most people are proud, not of those things which arouse respect, but of those which are unnecessary. Leo Tolstoy.
We say it casually. We mean, well, make me proud out there, kiddo. We say it as they trot out onto the soccer field. Make your parents proud, we say as they head off to college. And when they do great stuff, we reward them by letting them know that the mission has been accomplished. They've made us proud. We want this to motivate them. We use it oftentimes unconsciously to hold them accountable. But is this the way it should go? Doesn't it sort of imply that they owe us something, that our support is not unconditional or implicit? That if they don't score a goal or make the dean's list or land a summer internship, we are therefore not proud. Our kids don't owe us anything. After all, they didn't ask to be here. It is we who are obligated to them by virtue of our choice to bring them into this world. February 9th. Here's how to tie your family together. It is my pleasure that my children are free, Abraham Lincoln once said, happy and unrestrained by parental tyranny. Lincoln knew about parental tyranny. His father used force. He was controlling. He meant well, Abraham came to understand, but his father had few tools at his disposal, and the ones he did have didn't work. His kids were not fond of him. They did their best to get away from him as soon as they could. That's not what you want, is it? No, you want your kids to really listen, to buy in. You want them around. You want them to come to you. You want them to respect your rules and embody your values. You want them to do what they're supposed to do, the things that will make them successful. So how do you get them to do those things? Well, for most parents, the answer is to default to the easiest and most primal form of leadership, force. It's got a simple logic to it. You make them do it because I'm bigger than you, because I can take away the TV remote, because I said so. And it seems like it works for a while. Perhaps you remember how this worked from your own childhood. Eventually, the strategy falls apart over time. In the end, it turns out to be counterproductive. Okay, then listen to Lincoln. Love is the chain whereby to bind a child to its parents.